You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 232 by Rudolf Steiner, 14 lectures, entitled Mystery Knowledge and Mystery Centers, revised translation by Pauline Werle. This is Lecture 11, entitled The Secret of Plants, Metals, and Human Beings. From what I told you yesterday, you will perhaps understand me when I say of Aristotle, who in the 4th century B.C. brought together all the knowledge of ancient times, that although we find what was spread over Europe through his influence to be no more than a kind of system of logic, he nevertheless based himself on the foundations of the Greek mysteries, and indeed of all the mysteries of his time. I can go further and say that anyone who is in a position to receive a world conception, not merely with his intellect, but with his heartfelt understanding, will be able to feel, even in the logical and philosophical writings of Aristotle, that they have implicit within them a close and intimate connection with the secrets of nature. To spread over Europe a system of logic was the destiny of Aristotle, rather than, if I may so express it, his proper path of development. For after all, to give an illustration of this fact, it would be almost unthinkable that Plato could have become Alexander's teacher, whereas Aristotle was able to be. Plato, it is true, continued the teachings of the old mysteries, but he did so in his own way, in the form of ideas, in quotes. And for this very reason, he was the one who led humanity away from the secrets of nature, while Aristotle led back to them, as you will have gathered from the short account of him in my title, Riddles of Philosophy. We can come to realize this in more detail and completeness when we are able to form an idea of the content of the 7 years of instruction given by Aristotle to Alexander. Let me give you a brief summary of the content of this teaching, which was drawn from the ancient mysteries. In those times, it was the case that whenever one spoke in an authentic way about nature, the word did not convey what natural science understands by it today, namely the purely earthly phenomena, from which one then goes on to infer, in an external manner, the phenomena of the heavens beyond the earth. No, the human being was thought of always as a member and part of nature in the widest sense. And this necessitated looking also for the spirit in nature. For to regard human beings as devoid of soul or devoid of spirit was quite impossible in those olden times. And so in the mystery teaching about nature, we find that nature was thought of as extending far out into the cosmos, as far indeed as the cosmos was in any way accessible to human beings through their relationship to it. Now you must understand that all teaching that was seriously undertaken in those olden times did not make an appeal primarily to the intellect or to the faculty of observation. What we think of today as knowledge, in quotes, was really of very little account in those ancient times, even as late as the days of Aristotle. And if a modern historian of some particular science wants to give an account of the progress in thought, in his domain, he should really begin with Copernicus or Galileo. For anything he may add to his account by going further back is beside the point. And if he goes back as far as the knowledge of Greek times, what he says is mere fantasy. It is a continuation of the present back into earlier times, and it is utterly unreal. For even in the time of Aristotle, any education that was taken seriously involved a complete change in the very nature of the pupil, for it made an appeal not merely to thought and observation, but to the whole life of the human being. The acquisition of knowledge was meant to bring about a change, the essential thing in the mysteries being that the human being should become, through his education, an altogether different being from what he was before. And in Aristotle's time, in particular, the endeavor was made to bring about this transformation of subjecting the soul to two diametrically opposite impressions. The pupil who was to attain knowledge, step by step, was exhorted to feel his way into his natural surroundings with as much of his humanity as he was able. And his instruction was worded something like this, quote, "Look, you breathe the air. In summer the air you breathe is warm, while in winter it is cold. In winter you can perceive your own breath in the form of vapor, but it is invisible when you breathe the warm air in summertime." Close quote. A phenomenon like this was taken as a starting point. A teacher of those olden times did not try to make the connection with nature by saying, quote, "Here is a body which has such and such a temperature. I heat it in a retort, and it undergoes such and such a change." Close quote. No, he brought nature into direct contact with the human being himself by making him attentive to the feeling he experienced in connection with the breathing process. And the pupil learned to develop a true feeling on the one hand of the warmed air. In quotes, "Picture to yourself," said the teacher, quote, "what it really means, warmed air. It wants to rise, and you must feel when the warmed air comes toward you that something is trying to carry you out into far spaces. And now feel, in contrast to this, cold water in some form or other. Just feel it. You actually do not feel at home in it. In the warm air you feel at home. So much at home that the warm air tries to carry you out into far spaces. In cold water you feel unnatural and not at home. And you feel that if you go away from the cold water and leave it to do what it wants to do, out of its own nature, it will do something that has meaning for you and turn into snow crystals which fall to earth. You feel in your right place, outside the snow crystals, watching them from outside. The warm air you can only feel inside you, and you would gladly let yourself be carried by the warm ascending air into the far spaces of the cosmos. You can actually only feel the cold water outside you, and in order to have a relationship to it, you would prefer observing what it does by means of your senses." Close quote. These were the two opposite experiences to which the pupil was brought. If we describe it as, quote, "learning to feel the difference between what is outside and what is inside a human being," close quote, that is an empty expression. It really does not say very much. But warm air, in quotes, and cold water, in quotes, mean a great deal. Through these opposite experiences, a human being is placed into the world with his whole inner being. Outside begins to have meaning and reality when we think of it as cold and damp, and inside when we think of it as warm and gaseous. The contrast was experienced as having a qualitative character. A human being came to feel how he is placed qualitatively in the world. Then the teacher ceased speaking of things and spoke of the human being himself. He spoke about the warm air leading to the gods in the heights, and the damp cold to the subterranean demons. But this journey to the subterranean demons is at the same time connected with the knowledge of nature. Only the pupil must take with him, into the lower regions, the knowledge and experience he has acquired from the warm air in the heights, so that the lower regions cannot harm him. And when, with this inner experience of the contrast between what was warm and gaseous and what was cold and damp, the pupil approached nature, he was able, in his further experiences of the objects and processes in nature, to see altogether more deeply into the real being of the cosmos. Nowadays a chemist examines hydrogen and attributes to it certain properties. Then he observes space, finds something there which manifests the same properties as hydrogen does in the laboratory, and draws the conclusion that hydrogen also exists in space. Such a method of instruction would have seemed sheer nonsense even in Aristotle's time. One went to work then in quite a different way. When the inner experience of the pupil had been deepened in the way I have indicated, the teacher led him to observe what actually lives in flowers as they strive upward and open themselves to the expanses of cosmic space. He was being led in this way to a knowledge of the plants. Botany took the form of, quote, look into the opening petals of the flower, and notice what kind of impression it makes on you to see what is there raying out into cosmic space, close quote. And when the pupil, whose feelings had been deepened in the way I explained, gazed out over the opening blossoms, an inner knowledge, an inner illumination dawned within him. The flowers became the proclaimers on earth of cosmic secrets. The flowers told him about the cosmos. And in an impressive way, though always only in the way of gentle hints and intimations, the teacher then led the pupil to find, out of himself, the secret that streams from cosmic spaces into the being of the flower. The teacher asked him, quote, what do you really perceive when you look into the blossom as it opens and see the stamens raying out toward you? What do you actually perceive? Close quote. And the pupil was gradually brought to the point when he could answer, quote, the plants tell me that the cold and heavy earth has compelled them to dwell upon the earth, but they really have not come from the solid earth, but have only been planted and made secure in it. In reality, they are born of water, and they had their proper existence in all its vitality as water-born beings in the earth's previous existence, close quote. The moon existence, as I described in my book titled Occult Science. The pupil was brought to perceive that in the flowers he could see a reflection of the secrets and mysteries of the moon, which has taken its departure from the earth, and still preserves something of the pre-earthly moon quality. For the flowers did not tell him the same thing every night. What the flowers said when the moon stood in front of Leo was different from what they said when it stood in front of Virgo or Scorpio. For the flowers of the earth told of what the moon experienced as it revolved around the zodiac, the secrets and mysteries of the cosmos out there. It was of these that the flowers of the earth told. It was indeed true that through these things brought to the pupil, he was able to say out of the depths of his heart, quote, I look into the flowers. They reveal to me their kinship with the moon. Captives on earth are they, for they are beings born of water, close quote. The pupil was able to have this feeling because he had previously experienced the impression made on him by the chilling water. That experience enabled him now to acquire this knowledge from the flowers. And when the pupil was sufficiently familiar with the secret of the moon disclosed to him by the plants which sprout forth out of the earth, he was led a step further to contemplate the metals of the earth, the principal metals, lead, tin, iron, gold, copper, quicksilver, and silver. We spoke of them in another connection yesterday. And when he approached the metals with his feeling and understanding deepened in the way I have indicated, then he gradually made himself familiar with the secrets they told him, the secrets of the whole planetary system. Lead told him about Saturn, tin about Jupiter, iron about Mars, gold about the sun, copper about Venus, quicksilver about Mercury, and silver about the moon. But this time not in its relationship with the earth, but as a member of the whole cosmic order. And just as the pupil had discovered the secret of the flowers, he now discovered the secret of the metals. The first secret he learned was the flowers' secret, and the second one was the secret of the metals. This secret or mystery of the metals, which was given expression in the male statue of the Eleusinian Mysteries by means of the great planisphere that I described to you yesterday, still formed part of the education given in Aristotle's time. And in the secret of the metals was revealed the secret of the planets. Human feeling and perception were not so coarse as they are today. When the pupil looked at lead, its blue-gray color did not appear only to his physical eye, but also had a particular effect on his inner eye, EYE. In a certain respect, this blue-gray of the fresh lead extinguished all the other colors, and the pupil felt as if he were going out to meet this blue-gray metallic nature, as if he were moving with it. He came into a state of consciousness in which he had an experience of something entirely different from the present. He came completely into a mood of soul when, because the present was blotted out by the blue-gray, it was as though the whole past of the earth rose up before him, and the nature of Saturn stood revealed. In the case of gold, people point to external analogies to account for the fact that the ancients saw in gold a representative of the sun. They were by no means merely toying with an external analogy when they regarded the sun as of great value in the heavens and gold as of great value on earth. Really, nothing is too stupid for modern humanity to ascribe to the ancients. In reality, when they looked at gold with its brilliant yellow color, a color which is, so to say, self-contained, and see how plain and unpretentious, and at the same time, how proud it is in its outward appearance, they felt in very truth an immediate connection to their own blood circulation. With regard to the very quality of gold, a person had the feeling that he himself was within it. He felt his way into it. And through this perception, he was able to grasp the nature of the sun and of everything appertaining to it. For he felt how the quality of gold is allied to a quality of the sun which works in human blood. And so, taking the metals one by one, the pupil of the ancient mysteries came to a perception of the whole planetary system. And as he learned to apply his thinking to these things, and we must not imagine this to be as abstract as today's thinking, he came to think of the metals in the following way. Quote, "I ponder on the metals. They reveal to me their kinship with the planets. Captives on earth are they, for they are born of air." Close quote. It is a fact that the metals we find in the earth today came out of the cosmos in the form of air, and only during the moon existence did they gradually become fluid. They came first in the form of air when the earth was in its old sun condition. They acquired fluid form during the moon existence, and it is during earth existence that they have been taken captive in a set and rigid form. That was the second mystery that was disclosed to the pupil. The third mystery had to be approached by the pupil, learning to observe the differences existing between the peoples and the nations spread out over the earth. If one were to go to the continent of Africa with its characteristic climate, one would find that the people are quite different, even in the color of their skin, from the people of Hellas. Or if one were to travel to Asia, one would find that the people are different again. The Greeks had a fine feeling for these external differences in human beings. One of the most interesting writings of Aristotle that has come down to posterity is his book on physiognomy, by which not merely the physiognomy of the face is meant, but a study of the physiognomy of the whole human being was undertaken with a view to becoming familiar in this way with the real nature of the human being. He points out, for example, that a person's hair is curly or smooth according to the climate he lives in, and that it is not only the color of skin which varies with the climate of the land where he is born, but the whole way a human being expresses himself is different. Just as the pupil learned from the flowers to see a reflection of the moon mystery, and from the metals to see a reflection of the planets, he now learned from this third teaching the actual mystery of human beings on earth. In the natural science of those times, people made tremendous progress in the study of the variety of human characteristics on earth, and they went a long way toward obtaining an answer to the question, what is the archetypal human form at the root of the divine plan and purpose? And through a living study of human physiognomy over the earth, there arose in the inner being of the pupil the secret of the zodiac. For in conjunction with the planetary system and the moon, it is the zodiac which influences the earthly elements. It sends the winds in one direction at one season of the year, and another direction at another season, now wafting warm air over a particular region, now sweeping it with storms of cold rain. All these conditions affect the human being and enter deeply into his life. And the natural scientists of those times looked for the origins of these natural conditions in the influences that stream down upon the earth from the zodiac, modified by the planets, sun, and moon. Students of natural history in those times were especially interested when they saw someone with black curly hair, a ruddy complexion, a nose of such and such a shape, and so on, and they said, quote, "This human being refers me to the sign of Leo. Leo, raying out his forces, either weakened or strengthened by the planets, according to their position. He is a person who, in accordance with his karma, has such and such qualities in his liver. If, for instance, he has a quality in his liver which brings a trace of melancholy into his life of soul, then it is due to the fact that at a certain point of time Venus stood in a particular relation to Jupiter and gave a special character to Leo's rays. I can see cosmic influences in the particular nature of the temperament in connection with the liver. I can extend this to all the qualities of the different peoples on earth. In what human beings experience, in connection with the atmosphere of their environment, I can see the secret of the zodiac." Close quote. And when the pupil had been led thus far, enlightenment again came from his heart, and he clothed it somewhat in the following words, quote, "I experience the mysteries of the zodiac in the variety of human beings. I behold within me the kinship of this human variety with the fixed stars. In their variety, human beings live as captives on earth, for they are born of warmth." Close quote. Born, that is, out of warmth ether. From warmth ether, under the influence of the zodiac. In his physiognomy, the human being felt himself to be born out of warmth. And although he had undergone change during the moon epoch and again during the earth epoch, what he had attained in the ancient Saturn epoch was his true and original disposition. Just as he perceived the metallicity of the earth to be born of the sun, of the air and flower nature, plant nature, to be born of the moon, of the water, so did he perceive himself as a human being to be born of warmth. He had been prepared for all this by the feelings and perceptions stimulated in him when experiencing the nature of the warm and gaseous, and the cold and watery. At the time of Aristotle, people learned from observing human nature that a human being has an effect on the warm and gaseous element in a certain combination with the cold and watery element. By studying a person's physiognomy, they were able to answer the question, how much does this person give you of the warm and gaseous element? How much does he take from you of the cold and watery element? The development they had undergone in their souls enabled them to look at the human being accordingly, and gradually they learned to look at the whole of nature in this way. This prepared the way for the old, really genuine alchemy, which afterwards spread across Africa and Spain and certain parts of Central Europe. This was the way of perceiving everything in nature, everything in the world, every flower, animal, every cloud and rolling mist, sand and stones, sea and river, wood and meadow, according to the impression it gave of being warm and gaseous or cold and damp. And so people came to acquire in regard to nature a fine faculty of perception for four qualities. When they perceived the warm and gaseous, they developed a perception for warmth. But at the same time, in perceiving the air, they felt what warmth was for the gaseous element. And in the cold, they developed a perception for what is damp and what is dry. They acquired a fine sensitivity for these differentiations, and this sensitivity helped them to enter with their whole being into everything the world offered. Having adopted this standpoint, it was natural that Aristotle's pupil, Alexander the Great, regarded the whole region in which they both lived from this point of view. And being thoroughly equipped with this sensitivity, Alexander perceived all the Greek characteristics, insofar as they manifested in Macedonia, according to the qualities of damp and gaseous. And this determined and constituted the mood of his soul at a particular time in his life. And what from out of the special kind of initiation he received from Aristotle, he perceived to be the fundamental character of his immediate world, he regarded as being only half of what there is. Quote, "This can only be half the world," close quote, he told himself. You see, in those times, knowledge of natural things was really brought home to people so that they really experienced them, and such experience could lead to learning the following. Here's a diagram. Here you have a wind blowing from the northwest, if Macedonia is in the center, and here a southwesterly wind direction. Here again, a northeasterly wind, and lastly here, a southeasterly. Now, Aristotle's pupil, Alexander, had learned from his own experience to feel in what came from the climatic influences and the winds of the northwest the element of moist cold, and in what came from the southwest the element of moist warm. This was a perception of only half the world. In the instruction he was given, this perception was completed for him, and he himself was able to feel that what he was taught belonged to what he already knew through his own experience. He learned that the winds blowing from the northeast brought the element of dry cold, and the winds from the southeast the element of dry warm. So now he had acquired from the four wind directions the perception of dry cold, dry warm, warm moist, and cold moist. Being a true man of his time, he had the desire to reconcile these opposites. Namely, there in Macedonia, one's experience was limited to the cold and moist and the warm and moist. These must be united with the cold and dry and the fiery and dry, with what blows from the north of Asia and what blows from the south of Asia and comes across Asia. Here you have the source of the irresistible urge that lived in Alexander to go on his Asiatic campaigns. And from this example, you may see how different the conditions were then than in more recent times. Think of the education a prince receives today. Imagine a prince who is taught while on the march with his troops. Try to make a clear picture of what kind of relationship exists between the instruction in physics given to a prince by some tutor and what that prince then experiences in the campaign. What is done on war campaigns is not the kind of thing that normally slips out of a retort. Such an example shows particularly well how very far removed nowadays the knowledge thought fit to teach a young person and to form his inner being is from what he is in outer life. This was an era in which, from out of a knowledge of these things, they aimed for complete unity between what gives a person inner form and stature, and what brings about the way a person relates to the world in his deeds and actions. In those times, history began in the classroom. But we must not forget that the classroom in those days was a place that had an affinity to the mysteries, and the mysteries meant the world, and the world was seen to be the result of the forces that were in the mysteries. It was this which prompted the impulse to take across into Asia the natural sciences of those times. In a considerably filtered-down condition, they then went across Spain and through Europe. This can still be traced in the way Paracelsus expressed himself, also Jacob Burma and Gichtel, and the various other people who later had connections with such minds as Basil Valentine. But for the time being, knowledge in the form of abstract thought and mere logic was meant to be victorious, and the other part of Aristotle's teachings had to wait. Now the time has come, however, when these other things have waited long enough, and they must be rediscovered as the sum of the natural sciences. Alexander had, fundamentally speaking, to bury these secrets of nature in Asia for the time being, for only their corpses were brought across to Europe. It is not our task to galvanize these corpses, but to rediscover the original living truth. And we shall only really find the necessary enthusiasm for such a task when we can develop a warm feeling for what existed at that turning point of time, when we can perceive and appreciate the real purpose of Alexander's campaigns. For only to outward appearance were they campaigns of conquest. In reality, their object was to find the other side of the compass, to unravel the mystery of the other half of the world. They were also most certainly a search for a personal experience. A certain discomfort and lack of satisfaction was felt in the milieu restricted to cold and moist, and warm and moist, and the feeling of the other half of the compass was needed to create wholeness. The immense historical significance of this event in the evolution of the whole of the Western world will be a theme of the lectures that are to be held in the near future at the delegates meeting on the subject of the occult foundations of the historical life of humanity on Earth. The end of Lecture 11.